This is Audible.
Random House Audible presents Drowning Roof by Christina Schwartz. Drowning Roof Part 1 Chapter 1 Ruth remembered drowning. "That's impossible," Aunt Amanda said. "Must have been a dream." But Ruth maintained that she had drowned, insisted on it for years, even after she should have known better. Amanda. Of course I lied to Ruth. She was only a child. What should I have said? That her mother had been reckless. That I'd had to rescue her, give her new life, bring her up as my own. There are things children are not meant to know. I suppose people will say it was my fault, that if I'd not gone home that March in 1919, Matilda, my only sister, would not be dead. But I did go home. The way I saw it, I hadn't any choice. March 27th, 1919. That's a good place to begin. That's what I wrote in the top right corner of the page. Dear Maddie. The pen shook as I raised it, splattering ink. March 27th, 1919, I wrote on a fresh sheet. Dear Maddie. In the end, I didn't bother to write. I knew I would be welcome. After all, Maddie had been begging me to come home for months. And what could I say? I had no explanation. No explanation but the truth. And I certainly didn't want to tell that. The truth was that the hospital had asked me to leave. Not permanently, of course. "Of course we don't want you to go permanently, Miss Starkey," Dr. Nichols said. It wasn't clear whom he meant by we, since he and I were the only ones in the office. It made me nervous knowing there were others who had talked about me, perhaps whispering in the hallways, ducking around corners when they saw me coming. They probably gathered in this very office, sipped coffee, shook their heads, and tut-tutted me. Who were they? Dr. Nichols moved some papers around on his desk. He did not look at me. "When this is over," he cleared his throat, "when you're yourself again, then we'll reconsider." He was referring to my hallucinations, I believe, although it may have been the fainting, or even the accidents. He studied the desktop for a moment and then sighed, saying almost kindly, "You'll feel much better away from this stink, believe me." There was a stink in the hospital. A literal stink, of gangrenous flesh and vomit, of ammonia and burnt oatmeal and camphor, of urine and feces. But a nurse gets used to the smells and the screams, and the sight of the men missing pieces of themselves. And I was a brilliant nurse. I had the touch. Everybody said so. The men worshipped me. Those with faces lifted them toward me when I bent over their beds. Those with arms held them out. I loved being an angel, but I had to give it up. Dr. Nichols had a point. Somehow I had lost control. One morning I woke up sure, absolutely positive, that my legs had been sawn from my trunk. And although I quickly realized that I had only been dreaming, my legs were right there, two ridges under the blanket. I couldn't move them. Couldn't rise no matter how I tried. My roommate, Eliza Fox, had to pull me out of bed. Another time, I'm ashamed to say, I actually fainted across a soldier's chest while giving him a sponge bath. Several times I had to run from the wards to vomit. My inside spewed out every morning into bedpans and janitor's buckets and hastily twisted newspaper cones and the snowdrift behind the hydrangea hedge. Twice I lost the hearing in my left ear, and once I spent 4 hours sitting in the stairwell, waiting for my sight to return. Syringes flew out to stab my arms. Glass vials shattered in my hands. File drawers pinched the tips of my fingers. I forgot soldiers' names and the purpose of errands. 3 days in a row, I locked myself out of the room I shared with Eliza. And always I was so tired, so very tired, that I simply could not stay awake. no matter how often I splashed water on my face or how much black coffee I drank. Finally, I surrendered and fashioned myself a nest among the towels in the supply room. I slept there every afternoon from 1:30 to 2 until the day Ward F ran out of soap and Francis Patterson was sent to get some. Altogether, I had to admit they were right. I was beginning to make a better patient than a nurse. My body had got the better of me and could no longer be trusted. To tell the truth, I didn't know myself anymore. And so I agreed to go home, not to the Milwaukee boarding house full of unmarried nurses where Eliza and I had carefully divided the freezing mustard-colored room into her side and my side, but back to the farm where I had grown up, where the snowy hills were white as bleached linen, and where my sister rocked her little girl to sleep beside the kitchen stove while she waited for her husband to come back from the war. I knew that at home, where I belonged, I could set myself right again. Outside the train station, I drew the city's breath, yeasty from the breweries and bittersweet from the chocolate factory, into my lungs and felt better already. My grip on my bag was tight. I wasn't late or excessively early, and now for the first time in weeks I was hungry, ravenous in fact. I went into the station and stopped at a counter to buy myself a bag of peanuts with extra salt and a cup of coffee that didn't burn my tongue. When I'd finished the nuts, I was still hungry. "Would you wrap half a ham salad?" I said. "No, better make it a whole, and some of that chicken. And maybe a piece of pie. The cherry, please." Someone down the counter was drinking a chocolate milkshake that looked awfully good, and I was tempted to order one of those. "That's what I like," the counterman said, punching numbers into the register. "A woman who can eat." So I changed my mind about the milkshake. As I was paying my bill, they called my train. "One way, miss? Going home?" the conductor asked, steadying himself with his hip along the seat in front of me. I nearly began to explain that it wasn't right, really, to consider it home any longer, even though legally the farm was half mine. Really, it belonged to my sister now, since she lived there, had a family there, and I was just going back for a restorative visit because somehow my body had taken on a life of its own. I wanted to confess that I'd been banished because I had failed as a nurse, because no one, including me, believed that I could coax soldiers back into proper shape when I was such a mess myself. But it isn't in me to say such things out loud. "That's right," I said. He winked. "Tickets!" he bawled and lurched away down the swaying car. Spring meant even less in the country than it did in the city that year, and by the time we pulled up to the icy little platform in Nagawaki, the sky was heavy with unfallen snow. The wind bit at my face so that I had to duck my head. I watched the toes of my boots as I stepped down the slick platform stairs and picked my way over the snow that drifted across the street in long pulls like taffy. My steps took me 1, 2, 3 buildings down from the platform where I stopped at the door of Heinzelman's Bait and Tackle, 12 grubs for a penny. I went in. The bell over the door jingled, and the coals in the corner stove gave an answering glow to the sudden draft. Then the curtains behind the counter parted, and Mary Louise Lindgren emerged from the back room. She smiled when she saw me, beamed, you could say, and wiped her hands on her apron front in that nervous way she had as she hurried toward me. "Mandy, what are you doing home?" She put her hands on my shoulders, pressed her cheek against mine. "Oh, you're frozen, a block of ice." She held her warm palms to my face for a moment and then grabbed hold of my wrist and gave it a little tug without pausing to let me answer her question. "Come over near the stove. I can't believe it. Just can't believe it's you." I wondered when I heard the bell. I wondered who would be coming in at this hour, and I thought, it's probably Harry Stoltz, but of course it couldn't have been because he's over in Watertown. And then I thought... She would have gone on about what she'd supposed and what she'd thought after that and what she'd done next, but I interrupted. "I'm taking a vacation," I said. "A rest." It was true, in a way. "Matilda is going to be so happy," she frowned. "But why didn't she tell me? She was in here only 2 days ago." "Maddie doesn't know." That was all I needed to say, because she broke in immediately. "A surprise! How wonderful! And Mandy," She leaned toward me and lowered her voice discreetly, though there was no one else in the shop to hear. I have a surprise, too. She waited until she was sure she had my full attention. George and I may have a little one. She patted her apron front significantly. I didn't know what to say to this. Mary Louise had been pregnant every one of the 5 years since she and George Lindgren had been married, and she had lost all 5 of those babies, each when it was several months along. A person ought to know when to give up, I thought. A person ought not to court disaster. At the very least, she should be wary. She should hold some of her feelings back. But Mary Louise was incapable of reticence, and she didn't have the advantage of scientific training the way I did. She always acted as if nothing could possibly go wrong, as if this child's birth were written in the stars, and she need only wait for the blessed event. Only her hands hovering protectively over her belly betrayed the worry underneath. What she thought was growing could so easily amount to nothing at all. "It feels different this time," she said defensively, although I hadn't expressed my concern. "I hope so." Really, what else could I have said? We agreed then that I should be on my way while there was still light. A few steps from the store, knowing she would be watching, I turned to look back. She held up her hand, and as I mirrored her, I thought of the time when we were just alike, Mary Louise and I, both happy to be finished with school for the day, running and sliding along this very road, scanning the Tower of St. Michael's for the lantern light that we believed signaled the escape of a lunatic, talking about why Nettie Klefstad wasn't speaking to Ramona Mueller, and how we knew Bobby Weiss had cheated at spelling, and what to do with the penny after you rubbed it on a wart, and sometimes singing. Of course, that was before Maddie. By the time Maddie was old enough to go to school, Mary Louise and I walked this same road decorously, with our books squeezed tight against our chests, but Matilda ran ahead, pitching herself into snowbanks, as we had once done. "Watch me, Amanda! Watch me, Mary Louise!" she'd call. Or she would linger behind to study the snowflakes patterning her mitten and summon me back imperiously. "Mandy, look at this one! Hurry up, before it melts!" I could never make my sister understand that Mary Louise and I had important matters to discuss. For 5 minutes or so, Matilda would stay by my side, cocooned with me in a wool shawl. But inevitably, she'd pull away and run and slide until she exhausted herself and begged me to carry her. "Piggyback," she demanded. Yes, demanded, although she was much too heavy. "You're too big now, Maddie," I protested. I sighed. I rolled my eyes at Mary Louise, whose 8 brothers and sisters were never so much trouble, even altogether. But Matilda stamped her foot. She wailed and clung to me, so that eventually I bent my knees and she jumped on my back and wrapped her arms around my neck, tight enough to strangle. Matilda was always interrupting, always demanding, and I always gave in. I always did what she wanted. Always. Except that last time. When Matilda was born, I was 8 years old and not, in the neighbor lady's opinion, a promising child. "What a beautiful baby," Mrs. Youngbluth said, as she and Mrs. Tully and Mrs. Manigold crowded around Matilda's cradle and cooed over her pretty lips, her lovely chin. With 17 children among them, you'd have thought they'd seen enough babies. But Matilda, apparently, was special. "Amanda will be jealous, won't she," Mrs. Tully said, "to have such a pretty little sister." But my mother said, "No, Amanda loves her sister." She laid the baby in my lap to prove it. Why would I be jealous? Matilda was mine. The baby that everyone wanted for herself belonged to me. A photographer came to the house to take a picture of us on the day of Maddie's christening. They put me in the big green chair. Already my legs were long enough to touch the floor if I didn't sit back all the way. And I held her, her dress spilling white down my front, one of her tiny wet fingers tangled in the end of my braid, while outside, the April clouds chased each other across the sun, so that the room was bright one moment and shadowed the next. "Smile," the photographer pleaded, but I refused. At Mary Louise's house, I had seen a picture of the Madonna cradling her baby, and I intended to look like her, solemn and noble. With the pop and the flash and the smoke, Matilda began to cry. My mother started to lift her from me, but I was determined to hold on to my baby. I would be the one to comfort her. And Maddie, for her part, wound her fingers more tightly in my hair. She wouldn't let go until my mother opened those tiny hooks one by one. I turned now onto Glacier Road, which runs up a hill overlooking Nagawaki Lake. At the top, the wind hit me full force, scouring my cheeks and tearing at my coat. I gasped and struggled forward, my head low, as far as the ice house. There I rested, stamping my feet in the straw and flexing my fingers, unwinding my scarf and shaking it free of my frozen breath. I left the door partway open for light. Before me now, as I stood looking out, the land fell away down the steep slope, and through the trees the frozen lake lay like a white scar on the earth. I shifted right, adjusting my angle slightly, and the tree trunks parted to reveal the familiar dark stain amid the whiteness, a crescent crowned with the lace of leafless branches in the northeast corner of Taylor's Bay, the island that had once been mine. I shifted again and could make out on the island the green roof of the house where Maddie and Carl had lived until the war. Once I had thought this place was the only one like it in all the world, but now I knew better. Lakes were scattered all over this part of the country, their outlines different, but their innards just the same. They were drops and drips and splashes on the land. They were holes and craters lined with skin too thin to hold back the springs that rushed to fill them, and most of them were dotted here and there with stubborn little islands, knobs of land that refused to dip their heads under the water. To the old farmer who sold my parents their land, my island had been nothing, or worse than nothing, a useless piece of soil. He never mentioned it to my parents when he pushed the deed toward them across the heavy oak table in what had only moments before been his kitchen and was now ours. They didn't discover they owned the island until several years later. I was 12 and Maddie 4 the day my parents spread the papers out on that same kitchen table to determine whether a spring to the north that would have been handy for them really belonged to our neighbors, as the young Bluths claimed. "What's this here?" My mother tapped her index finger on a blob marked with an X that looked to be in the middle of nowhere. My father studied the map. "Well, Mother," he said, "it looks like we own the island out in Taylor's Bay." Maddie was standing close to him, as she always did, one arm crooked around his leg. He scooped her up and tossed her toward the ceiling. "What do you think of an island, Missy?" "Again!" she shrieked. "Again!" And so he tossed her several more times, while she squealed, until at last he lowered her to the ground, his large hands rucking her dress under her arms. "Do it again, please," she whined, pulling at his trouser. "Again, please, again." Finally he raised a warning finger, and she started to cry. He turned to me. "Take care of your sister," he said impatiently. "We're busy here." And then he and my mother went back to trying to bend the northern boundary. After everyone else was in bed that night, I crept down the stairs and unrolled the map to examine the shape for myself. How oddly small and plain it looked, so different from the rocky, tangled place I knew. I rubbed at it with my finger. On paper, it might have been no more than a smudge of blackberry jam. Under the rush of the wind now, I became aware of the ching-ching of sleigh bells coming up the road. I wrapped my muffler tight around my throat and lifted my bag. I was about to step outside and hail the driver, when the horse crested the hill and I saw just whose animal it was. I shrank back and pulled the door to. I had done something that I didn't want Joe Tully to know, something worse even than my dismissal, and I couldn't stand for him to see me with that shame in my heart. In the darkness, I pressed against the straw-covered blocks of ice, and, my eyes closed, my breathing stilled, waited for the bells to cease, for the sound of footsteps, for the light to flood against my eyelids, because surely he'd seen me, had at least seen something, and would wonder. Joe was not the sort who could ignore a glimpse of an intruder, or of someone who might need his help. The bells came on, nearer, nearer, until I could hear the horse snort and the hiss of the runners on the snow, and then they passed by and jingled more and more faintly, until at last they were buried beneath the wind. He must not have seen me after all. But if the stranger I had recently become was relieved, some other part of me shuddered with despair, and I found myself weeping, the tears searing my frozen cheeks, at the thought that I'd had to hide myself from a man I'd once loved. And then, finally, I had to go on. One can only cry so long, and it would be dark soon and colder. Although the wind was fierce, I had only one more hill to climb. At the very last, when I could see the yellow farmhouse and the smoke from the fieldstone chimney, I began to run, taking huge, wild steps, picking my feet up high out of the snow and throwing them down again, swinging my bag, as if I were just a girl, propelled by the excitement of coming home. I was about to knock at the kitchen door when it flew open. Matilda stood on tiptoe, her cheeks flushed from sitting near a warm fire. "Amanda, you've come back!" She had to lift her arms high to throw them around me, for while I had long ago grown into a tower, she had stayed tiny and delicate, like our mother, a little sprite. I was pleased by her embrace, but I was less demonstrative than my sister, and I stood rather awkwardly, still holding my bag, until she began to pull me inside. "Wait, Maddie! You don't want snow all over your clean floor," I stamped and brushed at my shoulders. She laughed. "Bring it in! Bring it in! Bring all of you in!" She poked me playfully in the ribs as she took my coat. "Getting a little stout, aren't you? Too much pie?" she giggled. "I'll be skin and bones again in no time, eating your cooking," I said. "Oh, I'm not going to cook anymore. Not now that you're here." We laughed at this, knowing how right she was. "Look at those boots, those gorgeous boots," she exclaimed, bending over to admire my city footwear, spoiled now with wading through the drifts for which they were perfectly unsuited. That was my Maddie, thrilled at a pair of new boots, not even thinking to ask uncomfortable questions about why I'd come or what I intended to do. She was simply pleased to have me there. "And Ruthie, where's my baby?" I asked. "Right here, of course." She swooped down on a pile of rumpled quilts that lay on the rocker near the stove and plucked the little girl out. "Wake up, Ruthie, your Aunt Mandy's here." "Oh, don't wake her," I begged, but it was too late. Ruth blinked at me and yawned. Matilda thrust her into my arms. "Here, you hold her." The way things had been with me lately, I was afraid the child might scream, but when I settled into the rocker, she nestled against my shoulder and went back to sleep. It was exactly as I'd hardly dared hope it would be, the three of us warm in that familiar kitchen. I almost forgot to ask after Carl. "He can see all right again," she said. "But there's some infection in the leg, and he still doesn't know when he'll be coming back." She told me in her letters about the gas that had blinded him, and the shrapnel that had made a hole in his thigh practically big enough to stick a fist through. I'd assured her that a man was pretty certain to recover from those wounds, but she wanted to worry. "You're here now, though," she said, raising her eyes to mine, and she tossed her head almost defiantly. So I would take care of her. That was all right, then. That was something I knew how to do. For a moment or two, I could almost believe that things were the way they had always been, before Carl or anyone else had come between us. Chapter 2 Ruth. Aunt Mandy told me to be quiet, but I didn't be quiet. And then my mother went away. Amanda. "My sister's gone," I told the sheriff. He yawned and rubbed his face. When there wasn't any law-breaking, which was most of the time, the sheriff was just Mr. Coots, a farmer. I'd gotten him out of bed. "What's that?" "I can't find Matilda." I shifted Ruth, bundled in a feather quilt against the cruel November night, to my other hip. My arms were nearly limp with weariness, and she was heavy, but I couldn't let her go. I'd been home less than a year, and I had lost my sister.
"Well, how long has she been gone?"
"Hours. I don't know how many. We all went to bed, and then something woke Ruth. That's when I saw that Maddie wasn't in her room, wasn't in the house at all."
"You still out on the island?"
He frowned, and I knew Matilda had been right. People had been wondering about us.
"You come over on the ice already."
Just then, Mrs. Coots appeared behind him. Why are they standing out in the cold, Cyrus? She scolded. Come in, sit down, and I'll get you something hot to drink. She had a very good face for trouble. She looked stricken, full of concern. Here, give me the little girl. Ain't you just frozen, sweetheart? She held her arms out for Ruth. No, I said. I pulled Ruth against me so hard that she yelped. We have to get home, in case Mattie comes back. I'll find her, Mrs. Coote said soothingly. The sheriff had already gone to put on his clothes. He'll bring her back. I turned then and went off across the frozen grass. When Ruth shivered, I opened my coat so she could share its warmth. Under the quilt, she had nothing on. Where were we going? I wasn't certain, despite what I had told Mrs. Coutts. Not back to the island, that was unthinkable. With no plan, I staggered along the same road I'd traveled 8 months before. This time with Ruth, heavy as an anchor, clutched to my chest. Although we were moving away from the water, the lake itself seemed to be beneath my skin, for I leaked and dripped with every painful step. My wet hair had frozen on my head. The front of my dress was sodden under my coat. My vision was blurred. But my feet knew the way, just as they had in March. Back I went to the dark, cold farmhouse, the place we never should have left, where we'd all have been safe, if not for me. Ruth was asleep by the time we reached home, her head drooping along my arm. Her nightgown was back on the island, so I wrapped her as well as I could in one of my father's old shirts and my mother's shawl. I lit the stove and rocked her in my lap while I waited for water to heat. Then I filled the hot water bottle and tucked it beside her in bed under the eiderdown. For a moment her deep breaths paused and I held my own breath, waiting for the worst. But she only sighed and slept on. Satisfied that she was warm and safe, I went down to the kitchen and removed my mittens. My hand wasn't as bad as I'd feared. Most of the blood had dried, and the punctures were small in circumference. Many of them were deep, however. There would be scars, a ring in the meat at the base of my thumb. Who could have imagined such a little thing would have such strength? Who would have thought she would struggle so fiercely? I found my father's whiskey and dabbed a little on my wounds. Then I drank a glass. People said it made you forget. When Ruth awoke the next morning in a room she hadn't slept in for months, she called for her mama. I was sitting in the kitchen, waiting for the night to be over. My body had striven against me for sleep, for escape from the sores and bruises and the paining muscles. But whenever I closed my eyes, what I saw behind them was unbearable. In the daylight, I'd promised myself, everything would be different. They would find Matilda at a neighbor's house somewhere along the lake, or maybe even in the woods around the bay. She would be wet, maybe, and freezing. She might even have caught a chill. Her dress would certainly be ruined, but that would be the worst of it. I would heat a bath for her and make a strong soup and bundle her into her bed. We wouldn't talk about what had happened. We'd only be glad that it was over and that we could go on as we had before. I had only to make it through the darkness, and then she would come home. I promised myself that. Or maybe nothing had happened. I hid my hand in my lap and told myself it had all been a nightmare. When the sun rose, Matilda would come down to the kitchen, and we would laugh about the craziness of dreams and how real they can seem, so that you wake up hardly able to breathe for the speed of your heart. She would say how silly I'd been not to slide into her bed for comfort, and how I would be no good to anyone without a night's sleep. She would tease me about being afraid of my own shadow, and we would make pancakes together for Ruth. Yes, that was how it would be when the sun came up. As long as I didn't check, that was important, as long as I didn't check to see that Matilda was in her bed, but simply waited faithfully through the night, in the daylight things would be different. So in the morning when Ruth called for her mother, I waited, listening for Matilda's step across the upstairs floor. I listened, and I heard it. Yes, I was quite sure I heard it. But Ruth didn't stop calling. She was crying now, a frustrated cry. Why wasn't Matilda comforting her? Finally, I went to Ruth. We'll let Matilda sleep, I said to myself as I climbed the stairs. She must be very tired. But the truth pierced me with every step. In between the moments when I was convinced that Matilda was most definitely in her bed, I knew she was gone. Deep under my heart, I knew it, but I refused to look at it squarely. My mind slipped off the idea. I focused on the shape of the spaces between the lilies of the valley on the wallpaper. I noticed the twist of red and blue in the rag rug at the top of the stairs. I thought hard about what was in the kitchen that could be cooked for breakfast. Ruth let me lift her from her crib, but when I set her down, she ran straight to Maddie's room. "Where's Mama?" she asked, so bewildered, so trusting it broke my heart. How could I tell her what I couldn't tell myself? My head would not make the words. "Shh, sweetheart," I said. "It wasn't the right thing to say. I know that. I know that. But it is what I said." "Shh, sweetheart, let's make some pancakes, shall we? Come on, let's you and me make some pancakes." "I want my mama," she said. And when I tried to take her by the hand to lead her down to the kitchen, she wrapped her arms and legs around the bedpost and held on. "I want my mama," she screamed over and over again. "Don't," I said. "Don't, it's all right. Really, it's all right. She'll come back soon." But Ruth would not be fooled. She wailed, and I stood there helplessly letting her despair for both of us. When Ruth's cries began to weaken, I felt suddenly tired, so tired that I thought my legs would give way beneath me. I picked her up then. She was too exhausted to protest any longer, and I pulled her onto Matilda's bed with me. The bed was stripped. We had been away from this house, this life, so long, so we lay right on the blue striped ticking, our cheeks pressed against ancient stains. My hand throbbed, and I couldn't stop shivering. I pulled the wool blanket that was folded at the foot of the bed over us and fell asleep. I dreamed that I was standing at the edge of the lake in summer. Across the dazzling water, I could see Matilda sitting on the rocks that rimmed the island and singing as a mermaid would. So she was all right. Of course she was all right. "Maddie!" I shouted, relief flooding my voice. "Maddie, over here!" But she wouldn't look at me. I waded in, then toward her. I pushed forward until the water encircled my waist and then cradled my bosom. How easy it would be to disappear beneath that inscrutable surface. There would be no gaping hole to show where I had sunk, no frenzy of turbulent waves to give evidence of my struggle. "Matilda," I called, my chin dipping below the water as I opened my mouth. But she looked away toward the opposite shore, as if she hadn't heard a sound. I couldn't shout again. The water ran into my mouth, my nose, my ears, my eyes. I was afraid now, and the water was heavier, harder to push. I could barely get a purchase with my feet on the sandy bottom. I clutched at the lake with my hands, but it gave me nothing to hold. Still, I kept going. Matilda was just ahead. I only had to keep going, and I would have her again. And then I heard her crying. "Yes, there you are," I thought, struggling as well as I could toward the noise. She sounded just as she had years and years ago, when she was my baby Maddie and wanted me to comfort her. "I'm coming, Maddie," I called, and water filled my mouth. I was almost there. The crying was louder, but my legs wouldn't move. I leaned forward. I stretched my arms out. There was no more breath in me, but I reached, I strained. I would have her. She was mine. And then I woke up. It was Ruth who was crying, Ruth who needed comfort. Drowning in grief, I clung to her for dear life. I had no one but Ruth now, and Ruth had no one but me. Ruth's mother had drowned. That was a fact. In December, they found her body, trapped in the ice of Nagawaki Lake. The Sentinel reported it, and Amanda clipped the articles and pasted them to the black pages of a scrapbook, so there could be no question about what had happened. December 4, 1919, woman missing. Mrs. Carl Newman of Glacier Road, Nagawaki, has been missing since the night of November 27th, according to her sister, Miss Amanda Starkey, also of Glacier Road. Anyone with knowledge of her whereabouts should contact the Nagawaki Sheriff's Department. December 6, 1919, missing woman found drowned. The body of Mrs. Carl Newman was found yesterday evening trapped in the ice on Nagawaki Lake. by Mr. C.J. Owens of 24 Prospect Avenue, Milwaukee, and his son Arthur, 5. Mrs. Newman had been missing since the night of November 27th. December 7th, 1919. Funeral for Mrs. Carl Newman. Funeral services for Mrs. Carl Newman are planned for 6 p.m. tomorrow at Our Savior Lutheran Church in Nagawaki. Mrs. Newman is survived by her husband Carl, recently serving in France with the 32nd Division, a daughter Ruth, and a sister Amanda Starkey. Miss Starkey has requested that instead of flowers, donations be sent to the Precious Blood Children's Home in Oconomowoc. Carl Newman had promised to take care of Matilda, and now he would need taking care of. In late December, more than a year after the war had ended, he finally wrote to say that they were sending him home. "I can't believe," the final paragraph began, "that in a month or two I'll hold your warm, sweet self again, my little Mattie bird." There was more, but Amanda, blushing, folded the letter hurriedly and stuffed it back into its flimsy envelope. From New York came a final telegram. "Home, February 12. Stop, 3:35 train." Amanda was a little surprised. Surely the letter she'd sent had reached him by now. Surely he knew how little was left for him in Nagawaki. But here he was coming, just the same. "He'll take a train to Paris, and then another train from Paris to the coast, and then he'll get on a ship, a boat bigger than a house." Many times Amanda had traced for Ruthie Carl's route across a world too vast for such a young child's comprehension. She had held Ruth's tiny finger and pulled it around the globe. Ruth only wanted to make the globe spin, but she was interested. "Where is my daddy now?" she asked every night when Amanda tucked her into the bed they were sharing. "He's having his breakfast now, a nice soft-boiled egg." Amanda had been surprised at how easily Ruth accepted the notion of the time difference, as if she thought the most outlandish things were likely to be true in a place as far away as France, or on a boat big enough to sail the ocean. "And what else?" Ruth asked. "And a piece of fish with bones. You wouldn't like it." "And then what will he do?" "I don't know, Ruth. Go to sleep now." Amanda regretted having told Ruth anything about Carl. With every word, he came nearer and grew larger. Amanda. Who knew what "my daddy" meant to Ruth? There was a father in Hansel and Gretel and a papa bear in Goldilocks. Neither of them was much good. I didn't think Carl was much good either, I can tell you that. Carl and Matilda met on the 4th of July when Mattie was 17. She'd insisted on going to Waukesha for the parade. Margaret Schwann was going, Harriet Lander, Will Audley, Fritz Kynast, all of them were going. It was a party, so she had to go too. "You'll go, won't you, Mandy?" she begged. She knew my father wouldn't let her go to anything like that without a chaperone. We were late, and the street was crowded, but Mattie pushed to the front of the sidewalk. She was standing on her toes, waving a little flag in each hand, and the red, white, and blue ribbons in her hair were rippling in the breeze when Carl marched by, beating a drum for the Bayside Meatpackers Band. He was good-looking, I'll give him that. He had a fine-boned, boyish face, an easy, swinging gait, and brown hair that fell into his eyes. The kind of looks a girl can make a lot of, if she's so inclined. He almost lost step trying to keep her in his view, and I knew, as well as she did, that we would have company at our picnic dinner. Finally, we spilled into the street behind the last of the tottering Civil War veterans and picked our way through the horse manure to the park. It was hot, as it always will be in Waukesha in July, so it was no surprise that Mattie loosened her dress at the neck and pushed her sleeves up along her lovely arms. And if this caused her skin to brown, who cared? Not Mattie. To her credit, she didn't look often over her shoulder as we laid our food under an elm, but dished out the bratwurst and potato salad and talked and laughed with Margaret and Harriet and Will and the others, as if nothing extraordinary would happen before they cut the cake. And, in fact, for her, it was not extraordinary that a young man should spot her while marching by and sooner or later would wish to marry her. On the morning of February 12th, Amanda rose in the dark, started a fire in the kitchen stove, and went out to the barn to feed the animals and to milk. She swept the wagon bed and reminded herself to ask Rudy, the hired man, to lay blankets down in case Carl wasn't able to sit up properly on the seat. Back inside, as the sun seeped weakly through the skeletal trees, she smoothed the quilt on the daybed in the back room, conveniently off the kitchen. With his bum leg, he wouldn't be able to walk well at first. Certainly, he wouldn't be able to manage the stairs. Oh, he would be helpless, all right. She plumped the pillows vigorously and then surveyed the room with satisfaction. Would the wound still need dressing? It was possible, depending on how many muscles the shrapnel had torn, how infected it had been, and how well it had been treated. Amanda had no faith in French hospitals. But then Carl was young and strong. He would heal quickly when she got to work on him. The narrow room was a good place for an invalid, Amanda knew. Her mother had gone there to have her headaches. It was far from the bedrooms upstairs, so that a little girl playing as quietly as she could might sometimes be quiet enough. Amanda. Mama had the apoplexy in August, the year Matilda met Carl. I'm not blaming them, although I do know Mama disapproved. Her father had been a captain with the Union Army, she reminded us. Any daughter of hers could do much better than a butcher. He isn't a butcher, Mama. He's a meat packer, I said. Under the table, Matilda drove the toe of her boot into my shin, but I was only speaking the truth. Anyway, as I said, I don't blame them, although their shocking behavior certainly didn't help. I blame the weather. It had been hot all summer, hot and so humid that just walking, just lifting your arms up over your head to take a plate out of the cupboard, could make you so tired you wanted to sit down. That morning felt as if someone had tucked a wool blanket tight over the world. Mama woke up delicate, not ill exactly, but not strong either. She hadn't slept well. No one had slept well for weeks, it seemed, and everything was a trial to her. The coffee tasted bitter. The clatter of the breakfast dishes hurt her ears. The oilcloth was sticky. The sun coming in the kitchen window stung her eyes. Her shoes pinched. "One of you take the sheep down to the lower meadow this morning," my father said, his head bent over his plate. "I'll do it," Mattie said quickly. My father nodded. He sliced his egg and toast in half and then turned the plate to slice them again. "Someone has to stay with Mother," he said, pushing a quarter of toast into his mouth. "She isn't well." I'd intended to do the shopping. We needed kerosene and brown thread and sugar, although I had hoped to go to town mostly to cool my face in the breeze during the buggy ride and to drink lemonade through a straw at the counter in Backy's store. My mother sighed and closed her eyes. "I'll stay," I said. After the others had gone, I cleared the table while Mama sipped her coffee. I was working the pump to get the water started at the sink when I heard her say, "I think I'll lay down a while." And then crockery crashed to the floor behind me. I dropped the pump handle and spun around. Mama's cup and saucer were smashed, and coffee speckled the wall. She stood, holding her left hand in her right, and stared at me, bewildered. "I don't know what happened. I just couldn't hold on to it anymore." "It's all right. I'll clean it up." Already I was reaching for the broom. "But what happened? I don't know what happened." She reached for my arm and leaned heavily on me as I helped her to the daybed. "I'll just lay down a while, then I'll feel better, don't you think?" She looked at me trustingly, hopefully, as if I knew something. "Of course you will. You're just tired," I assured her. And I believed what I said, because I'd had no medical training then. I went back to work in the kitchen, and by the time I'd finished the dishes and started the bread, she was asleep. The wind was coming up, hot and steady from the west. I decided it was a good day to wash the sheets. Her voice drifted up the stairs as I was pulling the cases off the pillows. "I'm cold, Amanda. Amanda, I'm cold." "Mama, you can't be cold," I called down. "It's 100 degrees in here." "But I'm cold." She drew out the last word until her voice quavered. I took her summer shawl off its hook behind the door and carried it down to her. "Why'd you take so long?" "I was upstairs." She pursed her lips, annoyed. "Put it around me. My arms feel so weak." I spread the shawl over her, tucking it between her shoulder and the wall so it wouldn't slide off. Then I lifted her head gently and plumped the pillow under it. "No wonder," she murmured. "What?" "Oh, nothing." She closed her eyes. But then, as I turned to go, she spoke again. "I was just thinking, it's no wonder that Joseph decided he didn't want you. You're so rough. Like a man, almost." Through the long window, I could see the sheep, snatching at what little grass was left in the yard behind the chicken coop. I stared at them, knowing something was wrong, not knowing what, until I remembered. Matilda was supposed to have taken the sheep down to the lower meadow. Where was she? I knew where she was, all right. I didn't bother to take off my apron. By the time the screen door slammed behind me, I was already halfway across the yard. The woods were buzzing and whirring, clicking and cooing with hot summer life. Sweat bees circled my head, and spider webs clung to my neck as I pushed my way down the overgrown path. I could feel the lake before I could see it. The coolness the wind carried off the water, the sense of space beyond the last clutch of honeysuckle and blackberry bramble. Our boat was gone, as I knew it would be, but I knew where the Tullys kept theirs, and I hurried along the shore to find it. It was buried in weeds, hardly touched all summer. I pushed it out into the water and scrambled aboard, and then I rowed hard toward my island. I was looking over my shoulder, awkwardly, trying to gauge how far I still had to go, when I caught a glimpse of her around the far side of the island. Just as I thought, there she was, while the rest of us worked, out to her waist in the lake, the skirt of her bathing costume floating around her middle like a black wool lily pad. I was angry, of course. I had half a mind to drag her into the boat and take her home dripping wet to get what was coming to her. But more than that, I wanted to feel the lovely water around my own ankles. We could take care of the sheep later. It would be easy with the two of us working together. I was about to call to her, my lips were actually coming together to sound her name, when I heard her squeal. He shot out of the water like a giant pike leaping for a dragonfly, spray shimmering all around. He splashed her as he fell back. Hooting in triumph, he struck his palm expertly against the water and sent a cascade that hit her full in the face. She shrank back for a moment, and I was prepared, old as she was, to hear her wail. But instead, she laughed. She dug her hands deep beneath the water and threw at him as much as her hands could carry. She was no match for him. I could see that, even as far away as I was. The water she splashed went in all directions at once. It would hardly have wet him if he'd not come closer. If he'd not let her splash him while he splashed her back, more gently now, but still wetting her thoroughly. And so they stood there splashing each other like children, laughing and shouting, one to the other and back again, as if no one else existed in all the world. Suddenly I wanted to be away. I was desperate not to be seen, alone in my boat, watching them together. I struggled to turn around, nearly losing an oar in my confusion, but at last I was rowing. I pushed as quickly and quietly back through the water as I'd come, until the island blocked my view of them and theirs of me. And I was safe. The moment I stepped back into the house, I could tell something awful had happened. The door to the back room was open, and from the kitchen I could just see the end of the daybed on which my mother's foot lay oddly twisted. I hurried in and found her half on the floor, her eyes open wide and her mouth moving, but no words coming out, only sounds, strange, terrible sounds, like the noises a giant baby would make playing with its tongue. I dragged her back onto the daybed and covered her again with a shawl. Quiet, I begged. Please, please be quiet. And then I ran to the barn for a horse and rode as fast as I could to the west field to find my father. Shh, Amanda said toward the ceiling of the room that was ready for Carl. Quiet. But she said it so softly, nearly whispering, that Ruth, awake now upstairs, didn't pause in the spirited conversation she was having with herself. Amanda went up to fetch her, wrapped her in a blanket, and carried her down to the warm kitchen. Ruth knew she was plenty old enough to walk, and she kicked her feet a little as they went down the stairs to prove it. "Shall we have oatmeal?" Amanda measured it out as she asked. "No," Ruth said. "Shall we have gingerbread?" Amanda stirred the oatmeal with a large wooden spoon. "No." "Shall we have parsnips?" "No." "What shall we have, then?" "Frogs," Ruth said, and she laughed as if she'd said the funniest thing in the world. "When my daddy comes home," Ruth said, pushing her spoon into her cereal, "will we go to the house with the green rug?"
"What house?"
"The house with the green rug where Mama is."
The sudden rush of feeling at the mention of Matilda nearly choked Amanda, and she gasped, fighting to stay above it. "Think of something else," she told herself frantically. Think how clever Ruth is, describing a cemetery plot as a house with a green rug. Of course you can go there, she said at last. Her voice was calm and steady. Your daddy will take you. But you understand, sweetheart, that your mama's in heaven, don't you?
Yes, Ruth said, and she conveyed a large spoonful of oatmeal into her mouth.
And if you're very good, someday you'll go to heaven, too. Amanda ate her breakfast standing up so that she could attend to other chores, shaking out the kitchen rug, washing the glass pane in the front door, as she thought of them. She was rinsing her bowl when Rudy stamped his boots on the porch and came in. He stood in front of the stove, rocking from foot to foot, his fingers tucked in his armpits.
It's a cold one, he said.
Do you think we should bring more blankets?
Wouldn't hurt. Might as well pile on everything we've got.
We'll leave at 2, then.
We'll be early.
Well, we can't be late, Rudy saluted.
2 it is,
she frowned. It was easy for him to make fun, but somebody had to take responsibility. Somebody had to see that things went as they ought. Ruth stirred her oatmeal, picked up a clump in her spoon, raised it high, and spilled it back into the bowl.
Ruth, don't play with your food.
Amanda took the bowl off the table and wiped the child's mouth with the dish rag. Ruth squirmed, pulling her face away from the sour smell.
Hold still.
Usually Amanda would have urged the girl to eat more, but not today. Today there wasn't time. She went to the back door and called the dogs, who came trotting over the drift that had piled high behind the snow fence.
Come in and get warm,
she said to them, setting the bowl on the floor. Was she going to get started on the dinner, or was she going to let the day get away from her? The lining of her coat was cold as she pushed her arms into the sleeves. She put on her mittens, picked up her basket, and stepped outside. The air burned her cheeks and instantly froze the inside of her nose. While the sun lay so bright on the snow, she had to squint her eyes nearly shut against the glare. The sky was as blue as heaven as she marched, lifting her feet high and then plunging them knee-deep into the snow, making her way to the root cellar. She banged at the ice around the cellar door with a shovel until she chipped away enough to pry the door open. By the time she reached the bottom of the stairs, she was blind in the gloom of the cellar after the bright sun outside. She had to stand still for a moment, one hand pressed against the dank wall, waiting for her eyes to adjust. At last, she could make out the vegetables in their barrels and bins. She would offer to buy his half of the farm, she thought, piling potatoes, apples, carrots, onions, and more potatoes in her basket. Not right away, but in time, when he'd healed and was growing restless. He would certainly be restless. He was no farmer, after all, and he was hardly a father. Hadn't he gone off when Ruth was only toddling the minute he'd heard the guns? He would be happy to have some cash, happy to be free to start his life again. And then everything would go back to the way it should be. She and Ruth would go on living on the farm. She would raise Ruth. A girl needed a mother, after all. Isn't that what Matilda would have wanted? The thought of her sister made Amanda's heart beat hard, and her breath come in shallow gasps. There wasn't enough air in the cold, dark cellar. Abandoning the vegetables that rolled out of her basket and onto the floor, she stumbled up the packed earth stairs and out into the brilliant blue sky. Amanda. Some weeks later, when Mama was a little better, not talking normally, but no longer making those hideous sounds, I told my father how I had seen Matilda and Carl together at the island. I thought he would send her away to think things over, the way he had sent me to Cousin Trudy when Joe was courting me. But he only sighed as he smoothed my mother's wavy hair with her silver-handled brush.
"A son-in-law would be nice," he said at last. "And now that Matilda's out of school, she can help with your mother. You could go to nursing school like you wanted."
What was he thinking? I couldn't go to nursing school now. Not now, when Mama needed me more than ever. One day, Miss Sizer and Mrs. Zinda stopped me on the street. "Isn't it wonderful all your parents are doing for the young people?" they exclaimed, shaking their heads and clucking their tongues with delight. They said it as if I were one of them and not like my sister, not a young person at all. People like a wedding, it seems. They don't care who is marrying or what it will do to other people's lives. I was Matilda's maid of honor. I wished them all the happiness in the world, and then I applied to nursing school, as I had always wanted. Amanda peeled potatoes, dropping the finished ones into a pot of cold water so they wouldn't go gray. "Hungry," Ruth said, coming to stand at her knee. You should have eaten more of your breakfast then, shouldn't you? I don't have time to be feeding you all day. But when she'd done the peeling, she spread a slice of bread with butter and pressed brown sugar thickly over that. You sit right here and eat it now, she said, holding the sandwich over Ruth's head until the child scrambled onto a chair. I don't want sugar and crumbs all over my nice clean floor.
You didn't have to make such a big dinner today, Rudy said as they sat down to pork chops and scalloped potatoes. Carl's bound to be hungry. I could have waited.
We have our big meal at noon here, Amanda said. He knows that.
Well, for one night, I mean.
I'm sure Carl wouldn't want us changing everything we do just to suit him, Rudy. Amanda put a piece of meat into her mouth and chewed it fiercely. Do you have the wagon ready?
Just about, Rudy said, and he dug into his potatoes without further comment.
When they'd finished, Rudy took the extra blankets out to the barn, and Amanda put bricks in the stove to heat. Then she called Ruth in from the yard, where the girl was tumbling in the snow, and half led her, half dragged her up the stairs to dress. How had the child gotten burrs in her hair in the middle of winter, Amanda marveled, as she gently picked apart Ruth's mats. Every few seconds, she couldn't resist bending close to rub her face against the girl's impossibly soft cheek, fiery red with the cold. And then she peeled off everything Ruth was wearing and started fresh. Clean underwear first, a cotton shirt with long sleeves, long wool stockings, three little petticoats, her best dress, and then a pinafore over that. Last night, just in time, she'd finished knitting a fancy sweater for Ruth to wear specially that afternoon. It had a cream-colored background and was studded with rosebuds of five different colors, each one a French knot. The whole thing had taken her months. She held it up now for Ruth to see.
Isn't it just gorgeous, Ruthie?
Ruth fingered a colored nub.
I like the blue ones, she said. See, they're flowers, roses.
Roses, Ruth repeated.
Hold out your arm.
It was difficult to get the sweater on now that Ruth was so fattened with fabrics, but finally Amanda had wormed her in and she buttoned it up to the girl's chin. Ruth looked a little stiff, like a doll.
Oh, you angel, Amanda exclaimed, giving her a squeeze.
Itchy, Ruth pulled at the neck.
No, honey, you'll stretch it.
No, itchy, it's itchy. Ruth squirmed and stamped her foot. She began undoing the buttons.
Ruth, it is not itchy.
Amanda pulled the girl's fingers away from the buttons and redid the two Ruth had managed to unfasten.
Wait until you get outside. It'll be nice and warm then. You'll like it.
Ruth threw her head back and screamed to the ceiling.
No, itchy!
She yanked at the collar, at the arms. Amanda grabbed hold of her wrist and Ruth let her knees go limp. She hung from Amanda's hands, shaking her head wildly and kicking her heels against the floor.
Ruth Sapphira Newman, stand up! You mind me now!
The girl was light and compact, easy to maneuver despite her struggling. With one swift movement, Amanda drew her against her knee. She swung hard, but her hand bounced off the thick material covering Ruth's bottom. Ruth barely felt it, but the shock of being punished made her scream harder.
Be quiet!
Amanda shouted louder than Ruth.
Be quiet!
And then quite suddenly she burst into tears herself.
Quiet!
She was weeping the words now. Please, be quiet! Ruth looked at her with surprise, and then she too began to cry. Amanda sank to the floor beside Ruth and lifted her into her lap. She bent over her so that Ruth fit like a snug bundle against her body and tucked her cheek over the girl's head.
Oh, my baby, she crooned, rocking. My poor baby girl.
After a while, she sniffed and sat up. The sweater had twisted. She straightened it and refastened the buttons that had come undone.
Come on, let's wash our faces.
Ruth stood near the basin while Amanda wiped a cold washcloth, first over Ruth's face and then over her own.
And now I'll have to do your hair again.
Amanda lifted Ruth so that she stood on the chair in front of the vanity. There they were in the mirror. Eyes swollen, hair tangled. Not at all the sweet picture Amanda had envisioned earlier. For the second time in 20 minutes, she worked a brush through Ruth's snarls.
Do you want a bow?
It was taking a chance, asking, because Ruth had to wear one. Really, the whole outfit would be ruined if she didn't wear a bow. The blue one, of course, it would have to be the blue one. but Amanda felt sure Ruth would want it. She held it on top of Ruth's head for the girl to see. Perfect.
Now, doesn't that look pretty?
No. Grimly, Amanda slid the pins under the ribbon anyway, securing it to Ruth's fine dark hair.
Run in your room now and play while I get ready, she said, lifting her down from the chair.
To her great relief, Ruth did.
His leg would heal, and then he would go, Amanda reminded herself, as she pulled the brush through her hair. He might promise to send money. Ruth would probably get a card now and again. And then, after a year or so, the cards would stop coming. He would have a new life somewhere, and she and Ruth would have theirs, right here where they belonged.
Chapter 3
From the train, Carl could see them waiting on the freezing platform, Amanda holding a little girl, his little girl it had to be, on her hip. When he stood in the doorway of the car, Amanda pointed and bent her head to the girl's ear. The girl raised a mittened hand and waved vaguely. Her eyes were on a dog with a red collar far down the platform. She might have been waving at anyone. He could walk only slowly, using two canes. It took a long time to make his way to them, step after faltering, unsteady step, along the platform that threatened to slide out from under him, against an icy wind that did its best to beat him back. Amanda set Ruth down, but the girl didn't run to meet him. The two of them stood like stones, waiting for him to come to them.
"Say hello to your daddy. Can you give your daddy a kiss?"
Amanda gave Ruth a little push with her palm against the back of the child's head. But Ruth shook the hand off and stepped behind her aunt's skirt.
"My daddy is far away."
"Never mind, Carl," Amanda said. "You know how children are." He didn't, though. He had no idea. In the street, Rudy was holding the horse. He shook Carl's hand and helped him into the wagon. He's relieved, Carl thought, to have another man here. And he closed his eyes for a moment under the weight of that responsibility. Rudy lifted Ruth and was about to swing her up and over the wagon's side to settle her in beside Carl, when Amanda stopped him with a hand on his arm.
"Ruthie wants to sit up front with me," she said.
She mounted to the seat and turned, holding her arms out for her girl, and then with a lurch, they were off. The train blew its whistle as the wagon was turning onto the road out of town. Carl watched the cars heave themselves away from the platform, gather speed, and finally slip smoothly away, carrying men on to St. Paul and Sioux Falls and Pocatello and Spokane. He lay back on his bed of hay and blankets and stared straight up at the dizzying pattern of branches against the darkening sky, so that he wouldn't have to witness the familiar route to the Starkey farm and think how different his homecoming might have been. Rudy looked back at him once or twice. "The trip's worn him out," he said to Amanda. "Give him a couple of days. He'll be better."
"Up and about in no time," Amanda said.
Amanda. It was obvious right from the start that he wasn't going to be able to take care of Ruth. She didn't take to him, for one thing. I could see that right off. And he made no effort, no effort at all. He was just as I'd expected. Matilda and Carl married in December, only 6 months after they'd met. A strange time for a wedding, people said with knowing smiles. And they were right, although they knew nothing. It never would have happened so fast if our father had been himself, if our mother had not been ill. Rumors sprang up like prairie fires, but I beat them down. People ought to have known by then that Maddie was a good girl, only impatient. Carl was nothing special, though, as far as I could see. He took Matilda to all the dances, and I have to admit he was a stylish dancer. But he couldn't say two words unless the subject was horses, and he didn't have a penny saved. "You don't get married for a dance partner," I told Maddie. But my sister was rash and stubborn. She wouldn't take advice from me. What did I know about why people got married? My mother was too ill to manage the ceremony, so I helped her into her pink bed jacket, and she waited, propped against the pillows, for the newly married couple to come to her.
"Look at these flowers Carl gave me, Mama," Matilda said, pushing the sheaf of forced lilies so close under our mother's nose that she drew her head back in alarm. "Isn't he something to get flowers like these in December?"
She held the lilies before her, her elbow crooked gracefully to support their heads, posing as the bride.
"Amanda," she said to me, "run down and get a vase."
Mama tried to say something. She clenched and unclenched the fingers of her good hand and worked her mouth around some incoherent syllables. Finally, she stretched her hand towards us. I took it. What is it, Mama? What do you want?
But she shook her head and pulled her hand away. She reached for Carl. She meant for him to take her hand.
Run down and get a vase, Amanda, Matilda said again. I want to leave the flowers in here for Mama.
On my way out of the room, I paused at the door to look back. What a pretty picture they made. Matilda had passed the lilies to Carl, and he stood holding them for her, while he told my father how Frenchie had favored her right foreleg on the trip from town. Beside him, Matilda with the